Welcome back, listeners, to Riddles in the Dark, the only Hobbit-related podcast you need to be listening to these days, because it is the best. The place to come to hear the most intelligent, most insightful discussion, and also the most unrelated non sequitur banter you can get. I'm your co-host Dave Kale, and with me, as always, is the Tolkien professor Corey Olson and Trish Lambert. And today we are talking the thing that probably everybody really, really wants to chat about, and that's right, bromances, specifically Hobbit dwarf bromances, and specifically Bilbo and Thorin. One thing that either everyone it seems to be one of the things that from the first film that people either absolutely loved, or people or the book purists were completely infuriated by why they were such good friends by the end, by that point in the book. That's way too early in the story. So, but we thought it was one of the most interesting parts, and especially because we immediately started speculating after the film came out about how they were going to handle the evolution of their friendship through the next two films. So that will be the focus for today, at least the evolution of their friendship through the second film. Right, Corey?
That's right. Okay, so yeah, that was an excellent intro, Dave.
You know? Thank you.
Welcome to Riddles in the Dark, where even digressions are superlative. yeah. Anyway, so Bilbo's relationship with the dwarves, of course, you know, the fact that some of this is changing in the films is one of the sort of inescapable consequences of one of the changes which was so inevitable when Peter Jackson made the film. And this is, you know, something we've touched on many times before, that of course one of the major challenges, one of the things that primarily inhibited him from the idea of doing The Hobbit for a long time, is what do you do with these 13 largely undifferentiated dwarves? And so in the book, of course, you've got most of the dwarves are almost complete non-entities. We know some information about whom they're connected to. That is, we have familial relationships among some of the dwarves, giving them some kind of identity. But other than that, very few of them have much in the way of personality. And obviously, they are infused with a great deal of, in fact, largely over-the-top personality in order to make them differentiable. And that was, I think, one of the things that Jackson really did superlatively well in the first film, was to take this gang of dwarves and make them all memorable. I would not have expected how well he succeeded in, you know, bringing us by the end of the first film to be able to say, you know, when you see a dwarf, you know, briefly in a crowd, to be like, there's Nori. I mean, like, I never would have expected to be recognizing Nori in a crowd, because in the book, Nori is, as I say, is an almost perfect non-entity. And again, this is, you know, I want to make it clear when I say that I'm not criticizing Tolkien's choice or saying that was inept on Tolkien's part. It was a deliberate choice. In fact, as I've said before, it's something that you can see as he revised The Hobbit, something that he deliberately increased, that he reduced the total number of speaking lines by other dwarves and really drew the focus instead to just a few of them as sort of a representative sample of the dwarves and invited us to get to know them. So one of the things that we can see, as usual, you know, this segment of the show is, you know, my little book review. So what I want to kind of go over here first is sort of the status of these different dwarves in the book, and in particular their relationship with Bilbo. And there are really three of them, with the exception, you know, other than Thorin, with whom Bilbo has any sort of persistent relationship in the book. There's Feely and Keely, and I'm not actually counting them as among the three. They're on a kind of a separate level because they do come in for, you know, private reference in the book. That is, that they get lines, and they do stuff on their own. They're singled out, but they don't. We don't get a really strong sense of their personality. There is a sense in which, because they're younger, they are connected with Bilbo. Bilbo is like, you know, the junior member of the party, even though he's not necessarily physically young, you know, greatly younger proportionally to the dwarves. Nevertheless, he's very much like the junior partner. And so the Feely and Keely, being very much the junior members of the party of the dwarves, seem to have a kind of camaraderie with Bilbo for that reason, and we see them kind of working shoulder to shoulder with Bilbo in ways that we don't necessarily see the other dwarves doing, like when Bilbo is working with them they're the first dwarves that he frees from the spiders, and they work with him to help free the rest of them from the spiders. They are the ones who help him. Thorin has to be bullied into it, but Feely and Keely cheerfully help Bilbo unpack the rest of the nearly comatose dwarves from the barrels at Lake Town and all that. So there are ways in which Feely and Keely and Bilbo are kind of operating on a more similar level. But we don't really get much of a very clear relationship between them. The three that I'm talking about are Balin, Bomber, and Dory. Of these, Dory, I would say, is probably, and again, here I'm just talking about the book, Dory's relationship with Bilbo, I would say, is sort of least well-developed, but the thing that keeps being repeated, Dory is the one who always carries Bilbo around places. It's Dory who's the one who puts Bilbo up on his back to carry him out of the goblin tunnels. It's Dory who helps Bilbo up the tree when he can't get up the tree to escape from the wolves. Dory jokes about this, you know, what do I look like, a porter? You know, his job is to carry the hobbit, apparently. Dory is, of course, the one whose legs Bilbo is holding on to when they're flying off to the eagle's eyrie. So, you know, there's that kind of physical connection between Dory and Bilbo. And Dory is, you know, although we don't see very much of his personality, and he and Bilbo don't ever seem to have a highly developed relationship, yet nevertheless, Dory is certainly friendly to Bilbo, and we can see that he is very helpful, and Bilbo profits from him a lot. You know, Dory is there to watch out for him. Bomber is a really interesting one, because Bomber is like to Bilbo in another way, in that Bomber and Bilbo are both, to some extent, outsiders. This is true from the beginning, and we can see this. The first place we really see this is when they're fleeing from the goblin tunnels, and Bilbo's being swapped around and carried on the backs of different dwarves. And when he's being carried by Bomber, that's when Bilbo, you know, cries out in one of the ways that he does and says, you know, why did I ever leave my nice hobbit hole? And Bomber, who's carrying him at the time, you know, says, why, oh, why did I ever bring a hobbit on a treasure hunt? You know, a silly little hobbit on a treasure hunt. But nevertheless, in telling us that, Tolkien also shows us that Bomber is sweating and shaking in his fear and terror and exhaustion. He's not particularly enjoying this either. And there's this, you know, so there seems to be, although Bilbo is the one expressing his desire that he had never come along in the first place, Bomber, who shares Bilbo's desire for regular meals, is also in a similar state of not being 100% comfortable, not being totally on board with the privations of the journey in ways that the other dwarves seem to be a little bit more enthusiastic about. Of course, when Bomber falls into the enchanted stream and comes out of his sleep, he and Bilbo are much more alike, or rather are much more so outsiders to the rest of the group. Bomber is very much not in step with the rest of them. Of course, he's being carried. But even after he wakes up, he is very much a sort of a deviant member of the party from then on. And this remains true, of course. The most poignant moment of connection between Bomber and Bilbo is the scene, which, of course, is, I assume, not going to happen in film two. But when Bilbo sneaks out to give the Arkenstone to Bard, Bomber is the one who's on watch. And he and Bilbo have that conversation, and they are clearly on the same page. You know, Bilbo's totally fed up and thinks that Thorin has totally lost it, and Bilbo has decided he's going to take matters into his own hands. Bomber hasn't gotten there. He's not decided to take any such action. But he does, he does definitely feel like Bilbo does. The two of them, I think, do have a bond in that way. They are, to some extent, outsiders. Balin, however, is the one who is really the closest friend, it seems, that Bilbo has. They are the two of them are closest. We get, Balin is the one who welcomes. Balin is, of course, the first one to show up at Bilbo's door. He is the one who welcomes Bilbo in. In part, this is because he's the watchman, right? So when Bilbo shows up, at the Green Dragon for their meeting, it's Balin who welcomes him into the group and congratulates him on making it in time. That's, of course, because he's the one standing watch looking out for him. But it begins to be Balin's role. When Balin exclaims about his incredible skill in sneaking, because of course he's wearing the ring, though the dwarves don't know it, and sneaks into the middle of their camp. You know, it's Balin's reintroduction of himself to Bilbo. When he takes off his hood and bows to him, that is really the moment of Bilbo's sort of full inclusion into the dwarves' party, and the moment when their opinion of him really changes. And Balin is really sort of the spokesperson for the change of their opinion to the dwarves. Again, he's the one who sort of, in reaching out to Bilbo, is the spokesperson. Balin is the one who, he's of course the second in command, of the party when Thorin is lost. After they're captured by the spiders, Balin is the spokesperson to the Elven King. Of course, we can see, or it seems like we can see from the trailer, that that's not going to happen in the film. But again, you think of the relationship, Balin in particular, in his relationship with Bilbo, when Bilbo reveals the ring right after the spider chase, it's Balin who comes after him about it and who, demands to hear the whole story, riddles and all, with the ring in its proper place. And, there's that moment of real affection where we get that dialogue of Balin as he's falling asleep and saying and chuckling about about Bilbo's story, and now looking back and realizing that it was because he had the invisibility ring that he sneaked past him, and we get him sort of cheerfully falling asleep saying good old Bilbo. And then of course in the end we get Balin and Bilbo, not at the very end, we get Balin and Bilbo as the exploration party who are going and checking out the front gate, and it's Balin and Bilbo who have the conversation. It's from Balin that Bilbo learns, about, this is what the valley used to look like, and it's through Balin that he seems to really begin to receive that sense, to be more in touch with the sense of the loss of the region. And, it's not just about the treasure, but about, what this place used to be and how many people have died and, the destruction that has happened. And then, of course, in the end, it's Balin who comes to visit him at Bag End with Gandalf in the final chapter years later. So, Balin is definitely, I think, the one who becomes personally closest to Bilbo. And there's definitely a bit of a mentor role there. Balin is the oldest one, second oldest to Thorin. In the film, Balin seems to be the oldest of all. But anyway, he definitely seems to be not just sort of a friend with Bilbo on equal grounds, but a mentor figure, one who's really sort of filling him in on how things were and helping to kind of integrate him not just into the company, but into sort of the quest and the significance of what's going on. So those are sort of the overall relationships that we see between Bilbo and the dwarves in the book. Now the question is, what are we going to see in the film? And of course, looking back on what we have seen in film one. So let's sort of start where I ended with Balin. What did you guys make of Balin's depiction in film one, and in particular his relationship with Bilbo?
Well, I said this on probably multiple episodes over and over again. right after the film, I really enjoyed the depictions of all the characters. I enjoyed the way that they filled out a lot of the dwarves, and even some of the changes they made to some of the the more main characters like Balin and Thorin and stuff. I you may recall I pointed out sort of the poignancy of the moment where Balin. So I really liked the Balin Thorin dynamic at the beginning. I liked how they strengthened that relationship, and they made Balin sort of his trusty stalwart advisor who's been with him since the beginning. And I really liked that moment where Balin pulls Thorin aside and says, you know, we don't really have to go do this. You've done right by us. This isn't necessary. Like, you don't owe this to us or anything. And I like that because, I mean, I thought it was a nice moment, but I also thought it was very sad because, of course, Balin sort of in some sense ignores his own advice later on when he goes and tries to recapture Moria. So Balin, I thought they did a fantastic job with. And I think it's pretty true to the book as well. He still occupies that kind of older mentor role with not just Thorin, but also with Bilbo and even some of the other dwarves. He also introduces the weird little flashback story while they're sitting camping in the mountains and stuff too.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that, because you're right, he certainly is being kept in that mentor role, but he's mentoring Thorin more than he is mentoring Bilbo. We don't see him interacting with Bilbo to the same extent. I liked the fact that we did get, at least to some extent, that same kind of Fewey and Kiwi and Bilbo operating on the same level, the way that Jackson interjected that into the troll sequence. And how that started with, you know, Bilbo and Fewey and Kiwi going off together. That actually kind of seemed to me sort of true to the spirit. Not that Fewey and Kiwi in the film are represented in exactly the same way as they are in the book. But again, that the way in which, you know, Bilbo and Fewey and Kiwi are in one sense in the same category as the junior members of the expedition. That sort of overall spirit seemed to be still functioning there in the troll sequence in the film. So I thought that was interesting. But I agree, they do seem to have, and it's a natural consequence of showing Thorin's character more, right? I mean, we didn't get any of the internal stuff in Thorin's character in the book as we were going along, not until near the very end. So if you're going to show us more of what's going on with Thorin, it makes a great deal of sense to amplify the relationship between Balin and Thorin, which certainly was close in the book. And I mean, at least we're led to understand that their relationship is a very close one, even though we don't see them interacting very much. But yeah, I agree. I mean, the way that he's, you know, that sort of combination of affection and devotion that Balin shows to Thorin, combined with that kind of, you know, wise counselor and advisor to Thorin, the way in which he serves openly as a link to the kingdom that was. I think it's very significant that Balin is the one who is depicted in that opening sequence. Like, you know, when we see Thorin pre-Attack of the Dragon, when we see Thorin back in the Erebor days, Balin is the one who's with him. It's Balin whose life he saves when Smaug first attacks there on the battlements. So we get that connection between the two of them going way back. So when Balin is speaking to him, you know, this is not just, it's not like, I mean, if Fewey or Kiwi were being like, hey, you know, Thorin, don't worry about it, we're fine the way we are. That might be easy for them to say because they don't know any different. You know, they've never been to Erebor. They don't remember it anyway, most likely, even if they have. And you know, whereas Balin, again, he's operating on Thorin's level, and he can sort of speak to him from that point of view. And of course, Balin being the central person of the Azanul Bazaar flashback also further emphasized that, having Balin again being the connection, and not only that, but again the way that which for Balin that was like a teaching moment, right? You know, let me teach you, Fewey and Kiwi, what it means to be a good king and why Thorin is such a good king, and you know how and when Thorin became king and why you should, you know, stop screwing around and take this seriously and take him seriously. You know that all fit really, really well. But again, although I loved the character of Balin and I thought they did a great job with it, the consequence of all that is that Balin's relationship with Bilbo himself is a great deal lesser in the film than it was in the book.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So
he's spread a little more thinly. He spends more time mentoring everybody.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Well, he's kind of the archivist of the group in the movie. you know, he's the one that gives us backstory, and then in the trailer, you know, he's the one that says, "That's a dragon." You know, he's kind of like the wise old sage guy, you know, that knows all the data kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, he does seem to have this, like, avuncular relationship with almost everybody. I mean, he's like all the dwarves' uncle. And you know, even with Dwalin, his brother, you know, it's clear that he's quite a bit senior to Dwalin, even though Dwalin was obviously there at Azanobazar. We saw him there. So he's not,
he apparently offed a Gundabad orc at Azanobazar, no longer Bolg.
Yes.
This is a little side thing we'll get to later, maybe.
I guess his role really is, I guess it's not necessary for him to have a particularly strong relationship with Bilbo, because in the books, he basically represents the one dwarf who is going out of his way to try and relate to Bilbo and understand where Bilbo's coming from before Bilbo has really earned their admiration and proved his usefulness. Like all the other dwarves except Bilbo once he delivers some value to them. They're not interested in who he is or where he's coming from. They're just interested in what he does for them. Balin's the one that really tries to understand him, you know, as Bilbo the Hobbit. In the movie, we get that they all have a relationship to him. In the book, they really just kind of ignore him. In the movie, we have Beaufort, who actually has a very Balin-esque moment when Bilbo's thinking about leaving before the goblin tunnels, and even Thorin and some of the others are relating to him in the sense that they've saved him on a couple of occasions, and they are interested in his background to the extent that they're saying that he doesn't belong. So I guess the Balin role has really kind of been kind of distributed among the different dwarves, and each dwarf has a slightly different reaction, but all kind of which were all sort of rolled into the character of Balin in the book.
Yeah, I mean that seems right. I mean, Beaufort is clearly the major difference. You know, Beaufort is clearly the major the major shift from book to film. I mean, Beaufort is one of the most invisible dwarves in the book. You know, he's in that category of dwarves who almost never.
My audio. Oh, yeah, okay. I wonder if the Beaufort will continue to be a standout, or if maybe in movies two, in the second movie, another dwarf relationship will kind of come forward. I wonder if Jackson's going to do that.
It is an interesting question, because you can see two different options for Jackson there, right? On the one hand, he could take what he has, you know, established in film one and really build on it, and make Beaufort and Bilbo's relationship closer, or he could try to distribute it. And having given us that glimpse into Beaufort's character, which we will presumably keep with us through the second film, he could, you know, then choose to shine the spotlight on some of the other characters, and have them relating to Bilbo more. I could definitely see that. It was interesting. Dory's role and his connection with Bilbo was almost completely removed. He wasn't really singled out for his support of Bilbo at all. Though again, I think, you know, Dave, the distinction you were just making seems to me to work as far as Balin being the one who goes out of his way to be kind to Bilbo, whereas Dory, he is willing to help, even self-sacrificially. I mean, when the wolves are coming in and Bilbo can't get up, he reaches down, and when he can't reach down, he gets out of the tree himself and boosts Bilbo up on his shoulders.
That's
his
true.
Own very great peril. So Dory is, you know, he's very willing to help, even at his own risk. But again, it's not like he's befriending Bilbo in this. We don't see him really reaching out in the same kind of way that we can see. We don't hear him speak affectionately of Bilbo in the way that we hear Balin speaking affectionately of Bilbo. But with Beaufort, you know, we do get, with Beaufort in the film, you know, we did definitely get more of that element. Although, as I say, there was sort of none of that given to Dory. And of course, you know, one of the things which also complicates, you know, I mentioned the Feely and Keeley relationship. One of the things that really complicates the Feely and Kiwi relationship in the film is that although they are, as I said before, still in the film too, in that same kind of junior outlier category in the company, personality-wise, they're now so different. You know, it seems to me that in personality, Feely and Kiwi represent the greatest contrast to Bilbo, certainly in film one. You know, like Dwalin's appearance in the film, and Balin, you know, so like when they come, Bilbo is uncomfortable. It's only when Feely and Kiwi come that things start to get really strange, and you know they start like wiping their feet on on his furniture and hand him all the, you know, so we see him like with that uncomfortable image of Bilbo with an arm full of weapons, which again is, you know, sure, their attitude towards adventure, which is also very much emphasized in the troll sequence, where we do see the three of them going off together and working together. But again, it's not working together in a similar spirit as it was in the book. It's working together in a very different spirit. So there's definitely more contrast there because of the way that Peter Jackson, sort of because of the direction that Peter Jackson has taken Feely and Kiwi's characters.
Should we probably start shifting to Thorin.
Are there characters in the film?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we should. I just wanted, before we did, any other characters in the film that we see relating to Bilbo in any other ways that we're sort of overlooking? We've got, you know, Balin and Beaufort and Bomber, I would say. We didn't talk about Bomber in the film. Bomber seems to have... Well, at least in film
Marx. Bomber's kind of the Harpo Marx, isn't he,
company? I mean, he's really kind of lost personality. He had a good deal more personality in the book. It's not always a pleasant personality. I mean, he's like a whiner and everything. But nevertheless, he definitely had a distinct personality, whereas he seems to be more a sort of a series of gags in the film. That's understandable, and I've been saying for a while, if there's going to be one character they're going to sacrifice for total comic relief, Bomber is a very natural candidate for that, because Tolkien uses him for comic relief. But that's not surprising to me. I will be interested to see if, as it appears from some of the shots that we've seen, that Bomber is in fact going to fall asleep and be carried through Mirkwood by them. I will be interested to see how Bomber's character develops. Because it may well be that what Peter Jackson is doing here is basically permitting Bomber's character to be a kind of brainless comedy and then shift. After that, to sort of make that shift more dramatic. Again, I'm not sure that's going to happen, but I think that might well happen.
So actually, one other character whose relationship with Bilbo we should probably discuss is Gandalf.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
How could we forget?
Yeah, exactly. Been thinking mostly about dwarves, but I'm trying to think of what the question I'm pondering right now is, what do I think are the primary differences between the way that Peter Jackson has depicted the Gandalf-Bilbo relationship in the film compared to their relationship in the book?
It's in many ways, it's pretty similar, actually, right? Like, he's not, early on, he doesn't show himself to be particularly close to Bilbo, not the way that he, you know, in the book he really kind of evolves from, like, just this sort of, you know, being kind of like, At the beginning of the book, he's Gandalf the Wizard, and he's kind of sort of, on sort of a level above, and we're not encouraged to relate to him directly as like as a character with feelings and motivations. By the end of the book, he's a little more relatable, and he's shown to be actually quite fond of Bilbo and very concerned about his safety and success and happiness. And I feel like the movie is actually pretty similar. I think the Gandalf at the beginning, Peter Jackson's obviously leveraging our previous experiences with Gandalf. Like he's
Yes.
totally with Gandalf more than any other character. They're playing up the Lord of the Rings film nostalgia, I think. They're doing a lot of similar
Yes.
stuff with him. And he is a little more personal in that he recounts in convincing Bilbo to go, he isn't just commanding him to go. He actually tries to convince him by telling him the story of his ancestors and family and stuff. But I think he but I still think that he's backed off a bit from Lord of the Rings Gandalf. Like they're definitely leveraging that nostalgia, but it's not just like good old same old Gandalf. I think he's a little more
Yeah.
standoffish than he was in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I mean, they clearly are, because they have to be turning the clock back, and clearly, he's trying to do that. Jackson, that is trying to do that. It's turning the clock back in the relationship between Gandalf and Bilbo in particular, Gandalf and the hobbits in general. So, thinking to, for instance, that really adorable moment in the Fellowship of the Ring when after Gandalf does his like I am swelling and growing and my shadow is filling the room and I am exerting my power to overcome the pull of the ring upon you, Bilbo, and then Bilbo does that like adorable little whimper thing and goes and hugs Gandalf. That kind of relationship is obviously not there. So like clearly they have to back off from that, right? They have to back up and be like, okay, here's Gandalf and Bilbo at the beginning of their relationship. But you're clearly right. They do leverage the Lord of the Rings connection. Gandalf and his relationship with, I'm thinking of to me the biggest difference between Gandalf in the film and Gandalf in the book is that scene that Peter Jackson gives us of the two of after Bilbo has fainted and Bilbo is sort of debating, can I go, the whole like I am a Baggins of Bag End, and Gandalf tells him, talks about, Bull Roarer and the invention of the game of golf. That scene is to me the biggest difference because we never get that. We never get any sense of intimacy. We know that Gandalf knows about Bilbo, but Bilbo doesn't know Gandalf personally, and the two of them don't have that kind of a personal interaction. In the book, it just doesn't happen. Gandalf is more presumptuous than anything. He sort of is invited to tea and shows up with the dwarves. Acts as if, he doesn't bully Bilbo into going. Bilbo chooses, but he kind of in chapter one bullies all of them, as in saying that, Bilbo is he has declared that Bilbo is the burglar, and anybody who has anything to say about that can, like basically if anybody doesn't like it, then Gandalf will just leave, and they can put up with as much bad luck as they like. And he's glowering at the dwarves, and he's glowering at Bilbo, and everybody shuts up and is like, okay, all right, we'll go along with it. That's the most that we get. That's Gandalf being persuasive. It is certainly not a quiet, private conversation where they talk about Bilbo's family history and Bilbo, is open about his misgivings and his fears and all this kind of stuff. So, that Gandalf as confidant, Gandalf as, trusted advisor, is not a role Gandalf plays with Bilbo at the beginning of the film. But that is more of something that we see, or sorry, at the beginning of the book, but it is more of what we see in the beginning of the film. By the end, of course, Gandalf is going, and Gandalf in his return, is going to be going to have much more of that relationship with Bilbo in the book, and the kind of joy, not just relief in the sense of like, oh, phew, the wizard is back and he can now take care of things, but the real pleasure that Bilbo has in seeing Gandalf again, when Gandalf reappears right before the Battle of Five Armies, is, I think, you know, sort of speaks a lot about the relationship between Gandalf and Bilbo. In the film, I thought it was interesting that Gandalf's relationship with Bilbo doesn't actually seem to me to develop all that much after that first sequence. There's the moment where he and Bilbo have that heart-to-heart about Sting, right? You know, about not using the sword. But other than that, I'm trying to think of other moments when we get real Gandalf-Bilbo moments in film one. After.
Really aren't any. It's more Thorin and Gandalf having, you know, sort of fighting. There's not a lot of development of Bilbo and Gandalf.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I sort of feel like it's a little more kind of, he's a little more standoffish than Lord of the Rings Gandalf, because in Lord of the Rings, throughout like Fellowship of the Ring, we constantly get these like Gandalf sitting down with Frodo and chatting with him and teaching him, or Gandalf yelling at Pippin, or, you know, Gandalf's like making the rounds, talking to all of the various company members and stuff. So he's definitely a little more, he's like at arm's length in this, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of that, you know, comes of having Gandalf being the post Lord of the Rings Gandalf, that is, the Hobbit Gandalf told from the post-Lord of the Rings perspective, is a person who is wiser, is better informed, and has much bigger fish to fry than the Gandalf in the published Hobbit does. So that's one consequence, I think, of telling the story within this frame. Meanwhile, like while the dwarves and Bilbo are all doing their thing at Rivendell, Gandalf is off having private councils with the wise, and you know, we don't get that in the book. We don't get that element of Gandalf. I mean, clearly he has, you know, he has a previous relationship with the people at Rivendell, and he is known and trusted there. That's clear in the book. But still, there isn't that sense of we are not reminded. This is only one small thing. Like, meanwhile, while Gandalf is traveling with the company, you know, part of his mind is elsewhere, and he's thinking about these other big picture things that have nothing to do with and are far beyond the, you know, the pay scale of Bilbo and the dwarves. We do get that sense in the film, which again I think is necessary when you're doing, you know, when you're doing it from this point of view. But I think that's another reason why we don't get the same kind of sort of intimate personal connections with Gandalf because of that level of differentiation.
Yeah.
The quest of the ring, it wasn't a side quest for Gandalf. You know, like his whole mind was focused on what they were doing when he's traveling with the company. Whereas here, again, this is a sideshow, and he knows it's a sideshow, and we can tell that he knows it's a sideshow. So, I think that necessarily puts Gandalf in his relationship with the company in a different, and therefore with Bilbo, in a different place in this film than it did in the book, or than it did in the previous films too. So anyway, yeah. So we should talk about Thorin, and Thorin's relationship with Bilbo too. Now, Thorin, you know, the big question is sort of
unusual because I have my own.
Go ahead.
we're having a.
I want to acknowledge I have my own battle of Azanulbazar going on behind me.
Oh really?
Oh dear.
What?
I'm sitting outside, and there's a big waste management truck over here. So it reminds me of when, at the end of the year last year, when Dave was, I think you were in the, like a hotel lobby.
Oh, yeah, and there
was like stuff going on behind
you. People being like strangled to death or beaten.
Yes. So I'm a little worried my background may sound like that, so I'm muting myself out. But I'm here and riveted to the conversation.
Oh, okay, great, good. Just wanted to make sure.
Good. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so Thorin. So basically, the question with Thorin is, even when we're talking about the film, we from the book perspective, we have a sense that we know where we're headed, right? The sort of the final destination of Thorin and Bilbo's relationship is the outbreak of hostility between Thorin and Bilbo, and when in the book Thorin threatens to kill Bilbo and then only grudgingly lets him go free, and then of course their final reconciliation on Thorin's deathbed. And I think that most of our conversations about Thorin and Bilbo in the film have been premised upon the fact that we are probably headed in the same directions with Thorin and Bilbo in the films, that we expect Thorin to die and to be reconciled with Bilbo on his deathbed, and for things to get pretty ugly between Thorin and Bilbo prior to that. So, with that kind of basic assumption, our question is, what is the trajectory going to be like? How are things going to go from where they went in the first film? How is that arc going to continue? And, of course, that was a major thing in the first film, major in that was the ending moment of the first film. Of course, the final moment was the opening of Smaug's eye, but the climactic scene of the first film is the reconciliation. Well, not the reconciliation, the conciliation, the sort of the final bond, establishment of a bond between Thorin and Bilbo, Bilbo's acceptance by Thorin. As a member of the company, as one of his people, whom faithfulness and a willing heart and whatever else, when Bilbo is finally counted among the number of people who have those things and whom Thorin is willing to rely on. So the first film saw Thorin's distrust and disrespect for Bilbo, and eventually Bilbo gaining that, and so Bilbo's own growth and his own coming to understand better what's going on, thanks largely to Beaufort, and then of course Thorin's acceptance of him. So the question is, where things are going to go from here, assuming we're still going to get to the descendant of rats. I always use the descendant of rats to refer to their fight. That's of course what the insult, one of the insults that that Thorin uses against Bilbo when he's threatening to throw him down off the walls. So if we're going to get to Descendant of Rats, how are we going to get there? And I think there are several issues involved here. One of them is the differences between Bilbo's point of view and Thorin's point of view. That's just the fact that they don't see eye to eye. In the book, this is a big thing. I mean, that's why Bilbo draws the line and gives away the Arkenstone, because he's like, look, okay, Thorin has totally lost perspective here. Somebody's got to take this, some like person who is still sane has to act like a sensible person, and it's going to have to be me. So again, that's not like I distrust Thorin or Thorin distrusts him. This is just, the two of them don't see eye to eye, and Bilbo becomes increasingly convinced that he's right and Thorin is wrong. So there's that element. Another thing which I think is likely to be a more prominent feature of the film than the book, as I have mentioned before, is the question of leadership. Thorin is a very strong leader, and Thorin, as their leader and as their king, is a much bigger focus of the film, very understandably, than it was in the book. Those passages where we are told that Bilbo had, of course, become the real leader of their company, that's easy to say in the book. That's going to be harder to execute in the film without consequences. You couldn't do that in the film without making a lot of change. I mean, Thorin has got to be completely emasculated before you can get to the point where Bilbo is the real leader and Thorin is just going along with whatever he says. I think that that's got to be a major factor. What do you think, Dave? How do you see the leadership dynamics evolving over the course of this? Because we're entering into the sequence where in the book, Bilbo's competency and the dwarves' reliance upon Bilbo's competency and eventually leadership is steadily increasing through the Mirkwood sequence and finally to the barrel escape.
Right. And what's interesting is that the thorn of the book doesn't correct me if I'm wrong, but he doesn't it's not like he displays a great deal of resentment about this fact, right?
No.
He just accepts it. He readily accepts it the way the rest of the dwarves. The dwarves are like passengers basically. They're just getting swept along by the story, right?
Yeah, to a large extent. And yeah, there's Thorin's own, in part because Thorin himself does not have that much development as a character until we get to the dragon sickness stuff later on.
Yeah.
But prior to that, he doesn't, you know, the focus of the story is so much on Bilbo. We don't get a lot of internal stuff of what's going on in Thorin's mind. And so therefore, there's no movement as far as the dynamics of his relationship with the rest of the party or any doubts about his own personal identity or anything like that.
Yep. And I think the movie, I feel like what the first film has set us up with is two competing Thorin dynamics. The first one being the fact that they've already established him as leader and king, and not just as desiring to be leader and king, but actually as capable. That's the whole point of Balin's story. And we also see him throughout making pretty good decisions. Maybe the decision to run out of the burning tree and fight Azog wasn't a particularly great one, but it was kind of heroic, you know. It was sort of a last charge type thing. But we see him rescuing Bilbo and helping and rescuing and protecting the dwarves. We see him when they're captured by the goblins, he and they're being threatened, he identifies himself, you know. He's basically putting his neck on the line in hopes of sparing the other dwarves. So we've established him like that. The other thing, though, is that so we would expect that if Bilbo starts stepping up and being a leader, that there would be conflict. But the other dynamic that's been established is Bilbo's already done this once. He stepped up and saved Thorin from being killed at the end, and Thorin's happy about this. And it's that act that causes Thorin to accept Bilbo. So Bilbo stepping up and being heroic and you know providing leadership isn't in fact what's in, gaining his acceptance by the company. Although you could argue if we have sort of a Thorin who sees himself as leader of the company and not particularly ready to share that, you could argue that Bilbo's actions at the end of the film, the first film, could be interpreted not as Bilbo taking on leadership role, but as Bilbo, providing useful service to his lord and liege, right? Like Bilbo wasn't really necessarily being a leader. It wasn't like he was challenging Thorin. You know, it's not like he grabbed Thorin by the arm before Thorin could run out of the tree and said, no, this is a dumb idea. Don't do this. You know, this is poor leadership on your part. Let's do this instead. Rather, it was Bilbo putting his neck on the line to save the rightful leader and King Thorin. So maybe they are actually, I was thinking that these were competing dynamics, but actually maybe they're compatible. Maybe that in fact is even setting things up even more so for Thorin to sort of think that Bilbo has taken, you know, his rightful position as subordinate.
Which would make the theft and transfer of the Arkenstone look more like a betrayal.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's one good reason to kind of keep the dynamic going that got started in movie one, which is what Dave was just talking about, you know, the defending his king thing. The other track I could see movie two going would be to actually start this tension, you know, that I think, like, as you were kind of saying, Corey, I mean, back more to the book, which is maybe once they get into Mirkwood with the spiders, with Bilbo saving them from the Elven King's Hall, that Bilbo takes on more of a leadership role, which could grate on Thorin. So we may start to see a deterioration even sometime in the second movie.
Yeah.
Right. And see, I wonder, what I'm wondering is exactly, with the question of Bilbo in a leadership role, it's a little bit harder for me to see the Martin Freeman Bilbo going in that direction very strongly, certainly to the point where he's kind of rivaling Thorin anytime very soon anyway. What I could see, however, is Bilbo becoming more outspoken from his kind of outsider perspective. This, I think, they've done pretty well in the films of how they've maintained, as is true in the book, how Bilbo just does not have the same value structure that the dwarves have, and that's clear. You know, that he's not going to just go along with what the dwarves say and with what the dwarves want because he does not think the same way. I think that this is likely to come into tension pretty quickly in the Elven King's Hall. It's hard for me to imagine. It's easy for me to imagine the other dwarves getting behind Thorin in the what seems inevitable hostility that's going to break out between Thorin and the Elven King. I can see the other dwarves siding with Thorin, some perhaps uncomfortably, but all of them siding. It's harder to see Bilbo doing that. So I could easily see that as a moment in the film where Bilbo starts to speak out against Thorin, not in the "don't follow Thorin, follow me instead" sense, but in the just as a dissenter, being like, you know, like, guys, I don't, you're wrong. Like, you know, this is not. You know, I don't see things this way, and I'm not going along with that, and I'm totally not comfortable with that. And in Lake Town, of course, in the book, that does happen in Lake Town. Mm-hmm. Bilbo doesn't oppose Thorin, doesn't speak out against Thorin, but Thorin and the dwarves are going around all smug and happy, and Bilbo's clearly in a different place.
Yeah,
and this is remains true on the mountain.
Yeah, you can easily imagine a trajectory where Bilbo's actions during the spider fight, which are sort of in kind with his actions at the end of the first film, sort of initially seeming like, you know, like Thorin sort of reacting to that, like, you know, good old reliable Bilbo doing his job. But when he starts to notice the esteem with which the other dwarves start to treat him, maybe starts feeling a little threatened. And then more of that in the dungeons of the Elven King, where Bilbo's sort of helping them out and making plans and rescuing them, and the dwarves increasingly turning to him, and Thorin, maybe even Thorin and Bilbo having a disagreement over what's the right plan of action, and Bilbo basically winning out, because after all, he's the only one who's not in the cell anyway. And so, and Bilbo just saying, right, no, look, we're doing it this way. I'm the one that's out here. This is what's happening. And asserting himself, and maybe Thorin sort of grumbling and going along with it, but sort of harboring some resentment over that. And then it could start coming out even more at Lake Town and in the approach to the mountain, where Bilbo is increasingly the dissenter and Thorin starting to resent that. Although I don't think they want, you know, here's a question. If they play it up too much, if they develop it too gradually, will that lessen the impact of the scene of Bilbo's betrayal?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends. Because, I mean, basically, you can do that in one of two ways. Right?
I have an idea before you get to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I think there's a delay here. Sorry about that. Well, yeah, I just wanted to get this in because listening to you guys talk, and then maybe, Corey, this might enter into kind of, you know, your answer to Dave's question. The other thing is that another possibility is that Bilbo doesn't change at all. In other words, we may just see him still operating at the same level he's been operating at. But Thorin, I think we have seen from the trailer and what we've seen so far, is going to be coming under more and more and more pressure from external sources. Thranduil is going to exert pressure on him. I mean, we see him giving Thranduil some killer looks. Apparently, you know, Bard is going to at least initially be resistant. You know, he's going to come under pressure at Lake Town. Bilbo could just turn into Thorin's whipping boy. You know, it may be a displacement thing where he's getting so much pressure and so much stress from external that he ends up taking it out on Bilbo without Bilbo necessarily changing much. So that's another dynamic that could happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that, especially since, you know, as I was thinking, you know, as I was just saying before, it's hard for me to see the Martin Freeman Bilbo consciously taking on a leadership role. But Dave, as you were suggesting, it doesn't have to be about Bilbo declaring himself a leader or setting himself up as a rival. It just has to do with the reactions of the other dwarves, right? I mean, if they are saying to me, I mean, if we get the dwarves more and more, so, you know, if Bilbo just does not think the same way that Thorin does and doesn't look at things the same way and speaks his mind, and the dwarves are increasingly saying, hey, yeah, Thorin, the Hobbit's right, that by itself can be perceived by Thorin as some kind of a threat, rather than, you know, and Bilbo doesn't have to be at all interested in setting himself up as a rival. But I think thinking about the way that it would build towards, what I was going to say is there are two ways in which I could see the sort of the climax of, oh, I guess, you know, you could say the low point, the nadir of the Thorin-Bilbo relationship could come suddenly, or it could be sort of a logical culmination. If their relationship remains good, then, you know, what's going to look like a complete betrayal could come as a total surprise to Thorin. It's not that I can't see them doing that. I could see them doing that. I could see them, because, you know, Trish, the other thing that you could say is that it could go the other way, right? Thorin, or Bilbo could become increasingly Thorin's confidant, you know, that as everybody else in the world seems to be against him, we could see Thorin relying more and more on Bilbo, and the two of them being more and more together, and Bilbo coming more and more into line with Thorin's thinking and respecting Thorin's point of view more and more. And then it seeming like, you know, 10 times the betrayal when finally Bilbo makes his different choice at the end. Or it could be something which is gradually building and gradually building and getting more and more explicit and, you know, just becomes the sort of long anticipated climax to that, the long anticipated crash at the end of that, at the end of that particular ride. And I can see either one of them playing pretty well.
Yeah. Well, from a movie drama standpoint, I would see that being probably more likely, this kind of, like you just said, you know, more and more confidant, more and more, you know, closer, closer, closer. So that when the betrayal does happen, I mean, it's a really big, you know, huge moment of, you know, Thorin's reaction. I mean, to me, that just seems like more Hollywood to me than some of the other things we've talked about.
Yeah, and one of the two things, I mean, I feel like one of those two things has to happen in order for the audience to be able to be okay with Thorin's reaction. Because it's one of the things, you know, I mean, that's going to be hard to build. Thorin has to, you know, we have to get somewhere, you know, we have to get, you know, in our minds, we have to get Thorin from I am embracing Bilbo, you know, on the Carrick, to I am threatening to throw Bilbo off some equally high precipice. And, you know, so that's not going to happen. It's not going to make sense to the audience unless it's either built too steadily and gradually so we can see it unfolding, or justified by some kind of traumatic action, such as, you know, what would seem like...
Well, that also brings in the dragon sickness subject, you know what I mean? Somewhere along the line, we're going to need to see Thorin start to get into the grip of dragon sickness, and I would think that would need to start a movie too, for just the reason you just said, which is to make it okay with the audience that, you know, we see him go over the edge, and then his, you know, rant at Bilbo makes sense, because not just about the Ark of Stone, but because he's obviously psychologically deranged from this dragon sickness.
Right. But see, this is where I think the film almost has to differ from the book. Because in the book, Thorin's own personality is not very fully developed prior to the dragon sickness. And so when we see Thorin sliding down into dragon sickness, there's kind of nothing else going on there. That is to say, in the film, we know Thorin is like a bundle of like insecurities and uncertainties and self-doubt, and you know, there are all these complexities to his character established in film one, which is going to be interacting with the dragon sickness. Of course, we even have the fact that he saw the dragon sickness, if we call it that, taking over Thror, and we saw, you know, his grief over that. And so, you know, we know that if he's going to succumb to the dragon sickness, it's going to be like one of those tragic situations of Thorin becoming the thing that he himself, you know, hated so much in his grandfather before. But again, even without that, you know, he's got his like, you know, his self-identity issues. He's got his you know, daddy and granddaddy issues. He's got his elf issues. I mean, he's got his thing with Thranduil and the apparent abandonment of Erebor by the elves. You know, he's got all those other things before Dragon Sickness comes into the picture, you know?
So, that's true. He's a ticking time bomb.
He's going to blow sooner or later, you know, no matter what happens. So I'm kind of wondering if all of these other things lead to, you know, a certain baseline of tension that then, you know, we see, you know, it's almost like I'm almost kind of imagining not that I'm suggesting that this would actually function allegorically or something like that, but that I'm thinking of the dragon sickness not as a sort of a totally new feature or unrelated feature, but the dragon sickness coming in as like almost like, you know, Thorin taking to drink at the end, almost like drunkenness, you know, something like finally he's just driven over the edge. And, you know, when he gets there, like he's already completely imbalanced and he needs like some way to cope. And so like Thorin like takes to gold as like, you know, some other totally stressed out and miserable person would take to booze, and this just throws him out, and he like goes on a treasure hoard bender, and like now we see him totally come off the rails at the end of his trajectory before he recovers himself at the end.
A hoard addict.
Exactly. So basically seeing it as sort of the final stage of his, you know, like sort of the downward spiral of his character before he comes out of the spiral at the end, rather than just like a completely, you know, a totally alien element or trying to integrate it. I don't know. I mean, so I think that's kind of how I would see, and basically the way that could map therefore onto his relationship with Bilbo is that it could be that there is some tension between him and Bilbo, because, you know, some of Bilbo's opposition, as I assume Bilbo is going to be in opposition to Thorin at various points, especially I would think in Mirkwood, in the Elven King's Halls, if not in Lake Town, there's going to be some resistance, but that Thorin doesn't really go over the edge, and we don't see him really become hostile and move strongly in the Descendant of Rats direction until he's also coming into the grip of the dragon sickness, as he does in the book. And that's what really puts him over from, you know, like troubled to clinical, basically.
Well, you know, Armitage's portrayal of Thorin is very Shakespearean, so I would think this coming off the rails is probably also going to be a very Shakespearean kind of, you know, a Hamlet, Macbeth kind of, you know, descending into madness thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think I've been talking about this, I've kind of had Macbeth a little bit in the back of my mind, actually, thinking about the way Macbeth comes off the rails in that play. And of course, it's different. I mean, Thorin's trajectory—it's not a tragic hero trajectory. You know, it's not like, you know, he gives in to this. You know, he, like Macbeth, who starts, you know, making bad decisions for like shakily justifiable reasons, and then the justifications become shakier as the choices become worse, until finally he's like a raving beast at the end of the play. You know, he is like, as he compares himself to a bear, you know, chained in an arena, you know, in a bear baiting, which was such a popular sport in Elizabethan times. So, and Thorin's arc is not the same initial arc of Macbeth's, but
Well, but the initial motivation is not that different. I mean, you know, Macbeth is wanting to go after the crown. I mean, he's wanting to usurp, basically, right? I mean, his obsession is that. But I mean, Thorin's, you know, it's still an obsession based motivation in both cases, right?
Yeah, it is.
I mean Thor's not going around killing people and stuff, but still.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, you don't have the, you know, simply the ambition. I mean, the main difference is the self-centeredness. You know, from the beginning with Macbeth, it's, you know, his own ambition and what he wants for himself. And that's not the issue with Thorin. There's more to it than that. And it has more to do with insecurities. Macbeth is not insecure at all, at the beginning, I mean. He becomes insecure once he becomes king, but again, that's a consequence of the paranoia that comes from the decision that he's making. But again, I'm just thinking of the overall sort of shape of it and how he, Macbeth, comes off the rails at the end, that there would be sort of a shift. And, you know, the moment for Macbeth, the moment of the shift, plainly, is when he goes back to the witches the second time and the prophecies are given. And, you know, from then on, he's, you know, he's slaughtering people and he's just like a complete madman. Because he's so confident, so falsely confident. So I wonder if we're going to get a similar, you know, that kind of a pattern, that kind of a, again, you know, in some ways, as I say, Macbeth isn't a great parallel for Thorin, but again, I'm just thinking of that kind of devolution. You could go Othello too, though, you know, the whole sexual jealousy thing is sort of.
Well, that's true. I was thinking Hamlet Macbeth hybrid, but you're right. Othello could be. But kind of that whole tragic hero sort of going a little nuts thing. I mean, that's, you know, you could almost sort of say it's an amalgamation of those three Shakespearean characters.
Yeah. I mean, I think you know, there are ways that we can see that kind of thing. And I agree with your statement about Armitage's depiction of Thorin thus far being sort of a rather Shakespearean character. But again, how does this mean in the short term? It's going to play. I mean, here we're thinking about the crash at the end, but the crash seems likeliest to come in film three. So how is it going to be built up to? And I think, you know, a lot of this really comes down to the depiction of Bilbo's character as much as it does the depiction of Thorin's. Is Bilbo actually going to be speaking out against Thorin? Is he, you know, or are we going to have the, you know, are we going to carry on and continue the, you know, sort of budding romance that we got on the Carrick at the end of film one? That could well be. And Dave, you know, I go back
could
to
be
what
very
you were
short-lived,
about...
couldn't it?
It could be. It could be very short-lived. I mean, there could be, you know, Thorin could start getting, Bilbo could start getting uncomfortable. You know, again, because that would work, I think, from Bilbo's perspective. You know, film one is Bilbo's on the outside and he doesn't even want in. And then he kind of wants in, but he's not let in. And then at the end, he's finally let in. So now at the end of film one, he's finally an insider. He's finally welcomed in. At the beginning of film two, Bilbo is now an insider and he finally looks around him and says, actually, it's kind of weird in here. I don't really want to be an insider anymore. Now that I'm inside with these guys, I'm kind of uncomfortable. And the tension begins right away with Thorin. I could see that happening. Or we could have more of a sort of a struggle on Bilbo's part. Again, we've been talking all about the trajectory of Thorin's character, but what about the trajectory of Bilbo's character? Do we see him... he clearly, both in book and film, has a different value system to the dwarves, and has a different outlook and a different attitude than the dwarves. Do we see Bilbo in the second film progressively suppressing that more and becoming more like them, or basically allowing himself to be more Baggins-like, and being more comfortable with that and trying less hard to fit in? I could see either one of those things happening in the second film. If he becomes more sort of openly Bagginsish and has less anxiety about how he fits in and ceases to try to become like the dwarves and fit in, then I would think his tension with Thorin would be much more. If, on the other hand, we see him kind of you know, just becoming more Tookish and suppressing the Bagginsish part, and not being so clearly differentiated from the rest of the dwarves. If that happens, then I could see, you know, him and Thorin just getting closer and closer. Which do you guys think is more likely of those two scenarios?
I'm torn.
Yeah, good question. Dave, why don't you go first?
Man. I don't know. I really am torn about this. Because I'm concerned about this. I'm concerned about the possibility that if they slow develop the conflict between them too much, that'll lessen the impact of the betrayal scene. At the same time, if they don't develop it at all, then that will be like shocking and weird and like where did that come from?
Right. Right.
So they just need to balance it very carefully. The other thing too is I think they need to. If that betrayal scene is going to be particularly powerful in a sort of a personal way, they really do need to give us some time for the friendship to develop. Like if they immediately head into open conflict at the beginning of this film, then there won't be very much tragedy in their fallout, because it'll just be like, well, these guys never really got apart from that one moment at the end of the film. These guys never got along. So. There's part of me that really thinks that they need to spend most of this film as friends. That Bilbo will evolve into like that, and maybe this could actually heighten sort of Thorin's sense of betrayal. If Thorin kind of ushers Bilbo in as his confidant and his lieutenant, if he says like, you know, all right, you know, yeah, we should trust Bilbo, and hey, Bilbo, what do you think? And then Bilbo starts defying him late in the film or early next film, then Thorin will probably be even more, he'll feel even more betrayed because he did it to himself. He invited this guy in, so.
Right.
I think that's what I'm leaning toward. I think that's what I sort of, if I was going to gamble, that's what I would say.
Well, and you're certainly right that the reconciliation on Thorin's deathbed, if indeed that's how it's going to happen in the film, the reconciliation in Thorin's deathbed is going to lose a lot of its power if they do not have a really solid relationship first. You wouldn't want Bilbo and Thorin on his deathbed to be like, hey, now we're finally friends. You know, we've had a rough relationship, but for now on, for like, you know, the next 5 minutes, we're going to be really close finally. That would not be nearly so powerful as actually establishing a relationship between them. So I do agree with you that I think that in order for the ending to have the emotional power that I think it should have, we are going to need to have more than just one brief man hug on the Carrick.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm leaning toward.
Yeah,
I think that will lead to a more effective confrontation, and I think that'll make for just a more fun movie. I think we'd like to enjoy some bromance for a while. You know, come on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My big question is: will it stay a bromance all the way through movie two, or will we start to get some cracks showing toward the end of the second movie?
Yeah, I think that's probably,
you know,
true.
And because if we stay with the romance all the way through, you know, then we don't have a whole lot to develop the break, you know, in movie three. I agree with you. I think we do have to have them get closer and closer and closer. But I'm just wondering if we aren't going to start to see some cracks, maybe starting in Lake Town.
Well, okay. So here would be my question then. What would be the minimum required amount of time we would need for establishing a satisfactory bromance?
We need like, you know, a bromance expert to have on the show.
Exactly right. So when Bilbo and Thorin look back at the end,
are there any teenage girls listening to this podcast?
When Bilbo and Thorin look back at the end, you know, they'll be able to say, we'll always have the Carrick, right? But clearly they're going to need more than that. Bjorn, okay, we got the Bjorn sequence. So could they look back and say, well, we'll always have Mirkwood, right? Okay, we could do that. If we get Bilbo and Thorin, you know, like side by side, you know, the wacky odd couple of Thorin and Bilbo bonding together as they run away from bears and perhaps cross magical streams and fight off spiders, presumably. That would seem a certainly easily permissible amount of positive bromance before things start to turn a corner, either in the Elven King's Hall or maybe in Lakedown, and enable things to sort of start moving in the other direction before the end of the film. That could work. Or would you think it would need to be? Do you think it would need to go all the way to Lakedown? See, the Elven King's Hall is what I keep coming back to and wondering about.
Yeah,
because I think Thorin's
seems
Thorin's,
like a natural joint.
Yes, Thorin's bitter anti-elf thing. I just have a hard time seeing Bilbo being totally okay with that. I think that Thorin is doomed to be at least somewhat irrational about Thranduil and the elves, and it seems to me that Bilbo is much less likely to be irrational about the elves, and much more likely to be trying to persuade Thorin, at least, like, dude, you're totally overreacting, you got to get a grip about this, and Thorin not wanting to hear that. So that's why it's a little hard for me to imagine.
Yeah, that actually is a good, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine Bilbo and Thorin leaving the Elven King's Halls, you know, still skipping down the path with their arms linked. But maybe. And I'm not sure what would divide them. If the Wood Elves don't divide them, that is, if opinions about the Wood Elves don't divide them, what exactly would divide them in Laketown?
I don't know. One possibility is that the elf stuff divides them, but it doesn't boil over until Laketown. Maybe there's some other little trivial thing that Bilbo does to anger Thorin, and then that's when all the elf disagreements come to the surface. Because the one issue I have with the elf thing, on the one hand, I completely agree with you. It seems like the most natural first place to drive a wedge between them. My concern is that we're going to be getting this scene within the first quarter to a third of the film, which doesn't give much time for the honeymoon period between Bilbo and Thorin. I could be wrong about that. I mean, they you know, like, the first film definitely demonstrated that they're perfectly willing to get off to a nice slow start.
Well, if they're getting chased by bears within the first 15 minutes, it looks like it's probably not going to be quite so leisurely as the beginning of film one.
Yeah, good point.
I do agree. And the sequence with the spiders has got to take some time.
Yeah.
Especially if, and as I, you know, as, I mean, I remember.
Well, you know.
That with the whole thing with them carrying Bomber, apparently the Enchanted Stream or something like it is going to happen. So. Anyway, but I do agree. Anyway, sorry, Trish, go ahead.
Well, the other thing we don't know is how long is the trip from where we see them in the boat, you know, at the Lonely Mountain, up to the secret door going to take? I mean, we know they go by and see Dale, right? There could be time during that trek for there to become, and also we're getting closer to the mountain, closer to the effects of the Horde on Thorin. I mean, maybe we don't see anything start to crack until that trip from the boat up to the secret door.
Yeah. I could see. That seems to me the second most likely thing. If they don't start falling out over the elves, I would think the next most likely thing would be things would still be pretty much fine until they start approaching the Lonely Mountain. Thorin starts getting obsessive and like starts to come off the rails, and things with Bilbo start to get start to get shaky at that point. And, you know,
I mean, we've seen that scene where Thorin stomps on the key before it goes over the edge. For all we know, it might be Bilbo that accidentally dropped the keys.
So, right.
I mean, exactly. that could be a pretty, you know, combative moment, actually, in the movie.
Right. And also, don't forget, another very prominent scene in the book that we haven't mentioned as far as Thorin and Bilbo are concerned, but which is pretty revealing about the status of Thorin and Bilbo's relationship, is in the book, or Thorin sends Bilbo down and delivers that, which mocks, you know, just mocks his tone and style in delivering it afterwards. If Bilbo and, you know, if Bilbo and Thorin are like BFFs by the great idea. How about you go by yourself and confront the dragon? You know, in the book, that works fine because, you know, they're not BFFs.
Corey, you cut out a little bit there. I don't know if it was just me or if the other listeners heard, but you want to just say that again just in case?
Which starting when?
So like a minute ago. There's like a weird like popping noise coming. I think it's coming from you, not from Trish, because it's...
There's a lot of static. I thought it was on my end. Yeah.
Trish is hearing it too.
Other people.
Sorry about that. All right.
Uh oh.
You're still getting it?
Yes. No.
What is going on here?
Ah.
Just when we're getting.
It's almost like your connection. Your mic connection is, I know, this is terrible. It's like the big moment, the big reveal.
The universe doesn't want us they're trying to stop us.
Yeah, let's see.
Okay, you sound better now. I don't hear any static.
Yeah, I think we're fixed.
Is it okay? Okay.
Yes.
I didn't.
Just don't move. Whatever position you're in, Corey, don't move.
All right, I won't move. Okay. A big moment that we haven't really A big moment that we haven't really talked about from the book, that is, you know, really important for Thorin and Bilbo's relationship, is the scene when Thorin sends Bilbo down the tunnel after the secret door opens. And in the book, of course, you know, Thorin gets all pompous and delivers himself of one of his great high style Thorin speeches about how it's time for Bilbo to earn his reward, and Bilbo actually teases him for that. I mean, he actually mocks his style and gets a little bit irritated by it, essentially saying, look, I thought we were past this. I thought we, you know, I didn't think that we were employer and employee anymore. You know, I thought that I and you guys, the dwarves, not Thorin personally, but him and the dwarves were a little bit more than employer and employee at this point. So, but anyway, fine, I will go. If Thorin and Bilbo are in the film, you know, BFFs by this time, it's going to be a little bit awkward to, you know, for Thorin to be saying, okay, Bilbo, I've got a great idea. Why don't you go down? It's time for you to earn your reward. This is what we're paying you for. So do your job and go down and explore and confront the dragon by yourself. It's hard to see that happening in exactly that way. And I wonder how that's, you know, thinking about, you know, Thorin's character changing or, you know, tension growing when they're on the mountain. I'll be very interested to see how that scene works. One way around it in the film would be simply just to have it be Bilbo's entire idea. You know, if Bilbo simply volunteers, which of course gets back interestingly to the question we were discussing in the last episode, which is, are the dwarves going to know about the ring at that point or not? Because if they don't know about the ring, Bilbo might volunteer just to cover up the fact that he can use the ring. But anyway, I don't know. I will be interested to see how that particular moment plays, because it's a prominent moment in Bilbo and Thorin's relationship in the book.
Interesting.
This is a really interesting one. I mean, this is a lot more interesting than I expected it to be in terms of all the different possibilities.
Yeah. Well, let's.
You shouldn't be surprised. I personally think a lot of our best episodes have been on character stuff. I think first season, a lot of the most interesting discussions that we had and the things that we got the most interesting feedback on were regarding like characterization.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, let's go. You know, our riddle is about this, sort of the break or the potential break between Thorin and Bilbo. So let's go ahead and articulate our riddle so that we can talk more explicitly about the options. We've already been kind of talking around it a little bit. And the question is, by the end of film two, what is Thorin's attitude towards Bilbo? So, option A is the book answer. Dave, you wrote that down, right? Could you read the options?
I can. So, riddle. What is Thorin's attitude toward Bilbo by the end of The Hobbit: Desolation of Smaug? Option A, ever-increasing trust. And this is what we're calling a gradient question. type of riddle. They lie along a spectrum, and they are monotonically increasing in terms of hostility from A to D.
That's right.
So A is ever-increasing trust and dependence upon his judgment. This is the book answer. Because in the book, obviously, we don't have the sort of the bromance hug after the rescue from the pursuing orcs, since there's no pursuing orcs. So in the book, we're still kind of developing the Bilbo Thorin thing and Bilbo's abilities and the dwarves' trust of him at this point. So there's maybe more room for growth, but still we could imagine that the book might still follow that general trajectory. So A is ever increasing trust and dependence upon his judgment. Book answer. B is private suspicions and tension between them. So maybe what we see is Bilbo is not on board with the elf hating, but they don't come to blows over it. We just get like a resentful look from a comment and a resentful look from Thorin, but let's move on. Or maybe down in the dungeon, Bilbo, they're discussing a plan and Thorin's making a suggestion, and maybe Bilbo's getting a little uppity and he like runs roughshod over Thorin and says, no, we're doing it this way. And maybe Thorin acquiesces, but gives him kind of a baleful look or something through his bars. I think that would be sort of B, right?
Mm-hmm.
C is open resistance to Bilbo and his ideas, but not quite outright hostility. So we just start seeing them regularly disagreeing about everything and never on the same page, but he isn't yet, threatening bodily harm to Bilbo. And then D is outright hostility, rapidly approaching descendant of rats and throwing him down from the wall. So this means that by the end of the second film, we've reached the point that he's at in the book after Bilbo steals the Arkenstone.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be like absolutely violence
but it's,
against Bilbo.
But it's well on its way toward that, right?
Yes, yes. Open hostility. It's clear that things are in a bad place with Thorin and Bilbo. And
It's not going to – there's no way it's going to reach the point that it's at after the Arkenstone incident. But what we could say is that what D really means is that the on-screen dynamics make it plainly obvious – to people who haven't read the book that Bilbo and Thorin are heading for a confrontation.
Yeah. Yeah.
B and C could kind of sort of say hey, there's some troubles in paradise, but D is we see something coming even if we haven't read the book.
Yeah. 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 Now here's an extreme D answer.
Uh-oh.
I could imagine, I'm just going to throw this out there, I could imagine Thorin actually kicking Bilbo out even prior to the Arkenstone incident, or even film two ending with Bilbo getting kicked out by Thorin and told to leave the company, that he's not welcome anymore. I could imagine this happening. So that would be to me sort of like the extreme version of D.
Hmm.
So I don't know.
You've made us speechless.
Yep.
Yeah, well, you know, you kind of touched on that before we started the show today, and you know, it would be a very dramatic ending, but the thing is, I'm thinking that the kicking out from the company would be post Arkenstone blow up. I mean, it just seems to me like that would be more likely, which I think would be in movie 3.
Yeah, possibly. Though, you know, I don't know. I could see it. To imagine, well, I mean, this is a topic that we'll discuss much more fully, of course, when we talk about film 3, but how the handing over the Arkenstone is going to be handled, it is not at all obvious to me that in the film it's going to work like it does in the book. So I'm expecting some significant differences in the Arkenstone handing over and its aftermath. And so I could imagine a sequence where Bilbo already has the Arkenstone and is kicked out by Thorin. And then when next he confronts Thorin, it is after it has been revealed. So basically Thorin kicks Bilbo out, but without knowing that he has the Arkenstone.
Mm-hmm.
And that Bilbo takes the Arkenstone with him and decides to hand it over, and maybe even like to come, you know, not to be returning there, but to be coming as like an embassy, essentially, back to Thorin.
Right.
And that's where, yeah, like the Descendant of Wrath confrontation occurs.
Right.
This I could see.
Okay. Well, that's, yeah, that's believable.
But I don't know. So what do you guys think? What would you vote? I think Sharon is asking, have we decided where the second movie ends? Not specifically, though we've been for some weeks.
We still have to do a show on that one, don't we?
Yeah, we haven't done our show on that one. But we seem to have been operating under the general understanding that the second film is going to come in the general neighborhood of The Death of Smaug. Whether The Death of Smaug occurs in the second film or not, obviously Bilbo in the mountain confronting Smaug happens because it's in the trailer. So to me, the only real question as far as the Lonely Mountain plot is concerned is whether or not the death of Smaug happens in film 2 or not. But either, so I would think it seems relatively clear the death of Smaug has to be either at the end of the second film or the beginning of the third. And so, you know, that area is kind of what we're thinking. But in either case, it seems to me likely that it's going to be pre handing over of Arkenstone. So that I think is going to be a specifically film 3 issue. But anyway. Let's see. Oh, so Pete,
I'm still tending toward probably closer to is he? Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah, well, see, I was going to say the same thing as Pete, which is a C, you know, that I still kind of maintain that I think with Dave, you know, as Dave said earlier, I think we need to keep kind of the bromance alive for a good portion of movie 2, but I think some cracks need to be obvious to us. I mean, more obvious than just tensions and suspicions. So I'm going to go on record. I'm going to step out and go with C, that we do see that Thorin, you know, it's really obvious to us that Thorin's starting to have some serious problems with Bilbo, but we haven't gotten all the way to open hostility.
Right. We'll get like squabbling, but not anger and resentment. Anger and resentment, yeah, I think.
Right, and baleful looks, you know, that baleful look he gives, you know, that one where he looks up from under his brows, like the one we see him
at
getting
Thranduil. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if Thorin is looking at you like he looks at Thranduil, that's a bad sign, yes, definitely.
So we may see more of that. So I'm going with C, and I'm okay. Now I feel so relieved. I've made my decision.
Sharon has an interesting point. Sharon says, I don't think it would be a good trilogy, it would be good trilogy movie sense to have the gang broken up between movies. I think the final rending of the group and its repair will need to occur within one film. Possibly so. I mean, I think that the parallel that, who was it, Rachel, was making a few minutes ago about, you know, kicking Bilbo out being kind of like Frodo telling Sam to go home in that horrifying moment. in The Return of the King. I agree that it could kind of function like that, but I agree, you know, sort of thinking, sort of combining Sharon and Rachel's points, one can hardly imagine a movie break coming between those things, you know, having Frodo and Sam break up as they inexplicably do in that film, but then breaking the films there and like have them not reconciled again until the following film. That would have been very, very jarring and very difficult, even more jarring than it was. So,
by the way, I do want to acknowledge that Pete and Rachel actually came up with that at the same time. So I didn't want Pete to feel left out that he wasn't getting acknowledged.
Right. Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, exactly. No, you're right. I overlooked that in exactly the same minute. They did make that same comment. Good point. Thanks for pointing that out. So Rachel is also agreeing with Sharon's point, thinking that it would have to be in film three with hints of coming disaster in film two. So I would take it then, Sharon and Rachel, that both of you are making arguments basically against D, that there will not be open hostility, there will not be any kind of a real breach, whether or not Bilbo actually is, you know, kicked out of the company or not, that there won't be any actual schism during film two. Okay.
Did you see Brianna's comment about sort of the parallel between this and the handling of Gollum between films two and three?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, she says, this riddle is making me think of how they handled Gollum in film two and three. They had Sméagol succeeding in breaking from Gollum and coming to be on good terms with Frodo, but in the last moments, Gollum resurfaces and is set up for his character arc in film three. That's interesting. The hard thing is that although I've kind of at times made Thorin sound like he has multiple personalities, there isn't the same kind of internal dynamic as there was with Gollum in any of these characters. So I'm having a little bit of a harder time with the parallel exactly. Thinking about the Gollum-Frodo relationship, what we get at the end of The Two Towers certainly, you know, there we get Frodo. I mean, that, I guess that's what I would be thinking about most, is the relationship between Frodo and Gollum throughout The Two Towers, from the beginning when, you know, Frodo has pity on him, and then we see him having more and more empathy with Gollum, and that touching scene in the Dead Marshes when he, you know, reveals that he knows Sméagol's name, and Sméagol's really touched by this, and this seems to stir positive thoughts in Sméagol, and then we get the tragic misunderstanding, you know, when they're captured by Faramir, and then, you know, the resentment and the re-ascendancy of the Gollum, you know, of the Stinker at the end, and the clear foreshadowings of the betrayal to come at the end. So, I mean, in that sense, I think that we can see possibly a similar kind of arc. And I wonder whether they would do, you know, what that parallel makes me wonder is if they would do a similar thing, if they would have any kind of a tragic misunderstanding fuel the tension or foreshadow the break among them at the end. You could see them doing the Arkenstone thing that way, couldn't you? Having some kind of, not just Bilbo saying, okay, Thorin, I'm staging an intervention here, like you have gone over the edge, I'm taking things into my own hands, you know, you're wrong, and I'm just doing this because, you know, you need help. And instead having there being some kind of misunderstanding, have there be that element, because it's one of the really powerful things of the Gollum depiction in The Two Towers, is that moment of tragedy where he feels like he's been betrayed by Frodo. And Frodo hasn't betrayed him, but Gollum feels like he's been betrayed. And so when he goes back to being Gollum, he goes back to being Gollum, you know, sort of tragically, not for a good reason, or not, you know, for just due to a misunderstanding. I wonder if there will be any of that kind of tragic misunderstanding element.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's, huh. Good observation, Corey. Yeah, you have them every once in a while.
You know, I try every now and again.
I also, I'll be honest with you, thinking about that is really leading me to lean towards an A or B answer. I increasingly, like, I know I originally said that I thought that it probably would be weird if they didn't lay the seeds of their disagreement and hostility before the big betrayal scene, but I'm going back on that a little bit. I'm more and more thinking that I think that scene will be more powerful if it really is a personal betrayal. Like if Thorin's not just angry that Bilbo has stolen the Arkenstone and stuff, but that he is in fact that he's hurt.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know whether it could be A, but I'm going to pick A or B. It's just a matter of choosing between them for me.
Yeah, Yana has already gone on record with A, actually.
Ooh, good job.
Yeah, he says I think the moment will be way more powerful if it's out of the blue, at least for Thorin. So he's thinking sort of exactly in the same directions that you are. Yeah, and he says now he's getting more sure every second that it will be A. Dave, you are talking, you are confirming Yana in his vote there. Rachel opposes, however, by saying Thorin is already a bit on edge, obsessed with getting his kingdom back and unreasonably hostile towards the elves. The dragon sickness will be the undoing of it. Yeah, I mean, that's my biggest fear. My biggest resistance against A is just as Rachel's saying, Thorin's already too touchy. It's hard for me to see Thorin getting this, like, you know.
That's true. He's already gone at Gandalf, hasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's if anything, Thorin seems more inclined to snap at everybody, and more likely and you know more ready just to snap in general at any time.
True.
It's kind of hard for him to be like, that. I am blithely tripping through the daisies with Bilbo, and I never suspect a thing. This Thorin doesn't seem to play that way. So. I'd be surprised about that.
Plus, Gandalf is gone now, so he doesn't have any. You know, he doesn't have Gandalf to you know to beat up on now.
Exactly.
So you know, Bilbo would be the next logical one for him to.
Yeah, and that's actually another way to think about it, which we didn't even suggest before. Could Bilbo essentially step into that Gandalf role? Gandalf has been the one who's been, if anything, the rival of Thorin. You could see Gandalf and Thorin, or Bilbo and Thorin's relationship progressing in a, well, you know, now that Killjoy threatening wizard isn't around anymore, we can carry on with things and become friends. Or you could see Bilbo basically taking over the role of Gandalf, in Thorin's mind anyway, and now being the one. So now that Gandalf is gone, Bilbo's the biggest pain in the neck to Thorin, or the biggest threat to Thorin. I could also imagine that, but let's see. I got to get closer to committing here because I'm not quite sure.
I think all four of these answers
not to pick
are possible.
Okay. All right. So Dave says B. We're gonna get tensions. We're gonna get looks. We're gonna get
meaningful looks.
Meaningful looks and maybe grumbling, but we're not going to get we're not going to get fights. Trish thinks we're going to get arguments, but not hostility. You know, not anger and distrust.
Yana
but,
thinks things
disputes.
Will be peachy keen.
Yeah, Yana thinks everything is going to be just beautiful. Okay. I'm tempted to go with D out of sheer perversity. this usually happens when I vote last.
We need to keep that in mind, Dave. We need to make Gory go first.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, if you want to push me into saying something extreme and unreasonable, then you should make me go last.
Have me go last.
definitely how it's most likely to happen.
Well, you made some good cases for D, though, Corey. I mean, when we were first putting this together, I was thinking that was like the gimme, you know, we have to fill something in kind of answer, but it won't be, mm-hmm. you know, it'll be so not right. But you made some good arguments for D as a possibility.
Yeah, see, now Trish is trying to bait me into giving the extreme and unlikely answer. Let's see.
That's right. I'm encouraging you.
Yes. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. I got to say, I think things are going to be at least C. I'm debating between C and D because I think that Bilbo is going to be more outspoken than that. I think there's going to be arguments. I think it's hard for me to see the two of them not really disagreeing. And even I think that as Bilbo has increasingly developed, I mean, one thing that does happen in film one is that Bilbo develops a spine as the film goes on. And the moment when he confronts them at the end is a pretty gutsy moment on Bilbo's part. That is, you know, when he gives them the speech, the pre-Azog at the Burning Trees speech, you know, the like, you know, I get it. I know that you guys have never accepted me. Like, whatever, that's fine. But here's where I stand. That kind of outspokenness on Bilbo's part is something that he has grown into as a character over the course of the first film, and I don't see that receding. If anything, I see it increasing. And so at the end of the day, I cannot imagine Bilbo not coming to the place where he says, Thorin, I got to tell you, you are going bye-bye right now. Like, you are completely... You're totally beyond the reach of reason when it comes to wood elves. You are starting to become obsessed. I think that if anyone is going to speak truth to power where Thorin is concerned in film two, it's going to be either Bilbo or Thor or Balin or both. And Balin, I think, is more likely than Bilbo to err on the side of devotion and not say anything because he doesn't want to hurt Thorin's feelings or because he doesn't want to, or because he's like basically trying to think the best of Thorin and is giving him too much of the benefit of the doubt. Bilbo, I don't think, is going to do that. So I do see Bilbo, although I do think that, that Dave, you're right, that we do need to really establish their relationship firmly, their friendship firmly, so that there can be something to reconcile when we get to the end. I think that Bilbo's going to be outspoken. So therefore, I think that in my mind, means C is going to happen. It's the question of whether or not we cross the line into D and things get hostile. And I guess in the end, I am convinced by Rachel and Sharon that that's likely to be premature by the end of film two. But that we're going to be on the threshold of that. And that tensions might be, I would expect things to be on the brink of hostility, but probably still, the fellowship is probably still not going to break, to use Lord of the Rings language. I don't think that's going to happen at the end of the second film. Though I could imagine it, I don't expect it. So I'm going to say C. In the end, I'm agreeing with Trish. So there we go.
Big mistake.
Oh my goodness. I know, really. I was going to say, geez, Louise. Listen, Rachel, maybe Dave can answer this. Rachel wants to get a reading on the difference between B and C. Dave, what is that to you, the difference between B and C? or maybe Corey knows.
I think it's subtle, and probably the judges are going to end up making a judgment call on this. But I would say that B is sort of... A is there is no detectable disagreement or tension between them. As far as we can tell, things are hunky dory. C is there is irrefutable on screen evidence of disagreement in the form of them disagreeing, arguing, bad feelings,
openly speaking against each other.
Yes. B is
not hating each other, not being angry, I'm taking my ball and going home, but you know, openly speaking against each other in council.
B is more
arguing.
I would say B is more along the lines of somewhere between those. It's approximating between those. It's not quite. It's fairly obvious that things are not all hunky dory. But we're not yet at the
some
point
grumbling,
where
maybe.
They still appear to be roughly on the same page, or at least right. Or at least sort of tolerating one another. So maybe Bill, maybe it's clear that Thorin.
Maybe Bilbo rolls his eyes behind Thorin's back.
Yeah,
right?
Or vice versa. Thorin's not. Thorin's Bilbo clearly disapproves of Thorin's confrontation with the Elven King, but doesn't say or do anything about it. Thorin's not fully on board with Bilbo's plan for helping them escape, but acquiesces and goes along with it, doesn't resist.
Right. There are no arguments in either case, yeah. But there's tension. There's detectable tension.
Yeah.
You know, we can see that Bilbo's not comfortable. We can see that Thorin is getting resentful.
Yeah.
Maybe even like some exchange, perhaps like between Thorin and Balin, where we can see Thorin's irritation and sort of developing discomfort or distrust of Bilbo, but it's not reached the point where they're openly speaking against each other, where they're getting into verbal, you know, confrontations.
Yeah. Sharon says, if Thorin gives an audible back off, I'm the leader command, that would be C. I would say
yes.
That's C.
Definitely C.
Yeah. B would be more Thorin grumbling under his breath after acquiescing to Bilbo's plan.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I would expect B to manifest itself in a lot of, like, significant looks. I mean, there were many times in film one where Richard Armitage did a good job, as Martin Freeman did a good job, of sort of showing us what is going on inside the character without a verbal component, you know? And I would expect that to be largely what would be happening if B happens in the film.
Or also, I'm thinking it could be an aside, you know, like Thorin saying to Balin, you know, that Hobbit's getting a little big for his britches, or
right.
Bilbo saying to
right.
Beaufort, what's going on with Thorin? That would also be B in my mind, because there's not direct confrontation between the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah, now, Brianna makes a good point. She says this riddle feels very dependent on just how far film two is going to go in the story, just how much dragonness we are going to get to start shifting towards dragon.
Yeah,
sickness
that's
Thorin,
true.
Which is probably why I'm hesitant about nailing down my answer. I agree. It is tricky. I mean, if this film were to go, you know, all the way through, you know, the Arkenstone, and not the giving over of the Arkenstone, I wouldn't think. That I can't imagine happens in film two. But, you know, if we get all the way to the dwarves in possession of the Horde and Thorin obsessing about the Arkenstone, obviously that puts things on a very different footing than if we're ending with, you know, them on the side of the mountain before Smaug is dead. So I agree that is, you know...
But
sort of implicit in your answer in this, to some extent, is your sense of where it's going.
I don't know that that's true. I mean, we know we have to head toward that. I mean, we know we're heading toward that. I mean, anybody, I mean, just even if you haven't even seen the movie, you know, I mean, the book, we know we're heading toward that. I think, as you mentioned earlier, Thorin's already got enough, you know, issues, psychological issues, without worrying about dragon sickness to make this a viable riddle, even without, you know, knowing how far we're getting as far as dragon
right.
sickness goes.
Yeah,
so, I mean, I think it is possible.
I kind of agree. Like, on the one hand, I agree in general with Brianna that like it is sort of dependent on how far we get in the story. But I actually don't think that. I think the major joints in this character arc, like the Elven King's dungeons, Lake Town, the Arkenstone. I think are really the main ones. You could argue that like Bilbo sneaking down into the being compelled to sneak down into the Lonely Mountain in the treasure room to try and steal something is a point in this, but I don't think it's. I think the major things that could really drastically shift the dynamic, I think we know for a fact that they are or are not in this film. There's no way they're getting to the Arkenstone, the real the meaty Arkenstone stuff. Maybe Bilbo will find it, but there's no way that Thorin will find out yet. And the other stuff, the Elven King's dungeons, Lake Town and stuff, we know for a fact that's in the film. So actually, I think it does depend on how far we get, but I don't think there's any chance. I don't think there's anything, any major Thorin Bilbo changing event that we're in doubt about whether we'll get to it.
I suspect that's true, because again, the thing would be the Arkenstone, and as I said, I would be shocked if we got so far as... Now, I would not be shocked if we get to the theft of the Arkenstone, but I would be shocked if we really made a big deal of the Arkenstone yet.
And yeah, I agree.
And we can talk about that more later on.
I think we should do another episode on that, yeah.
But anyway...
Hey, I wanted to give an aside here. Carissa just shared with us that her 8-year-old heard her listening to this podcast and immediately had the great desire to watch the film, so The Hobbit is playing in her house now, as we speak.
Excellent. Yeah, cool. So okay, so yeah, I think I'm comfortable with that. I think C is where in the end I'm going. I feel at peace with this choice. We definitely do need to do an episode. We haven't really done an episode on Smaug yet. You know, we really need to talk about Smaug and Smaug.
No, we haven't, and we need to do an episode on the ending of the movie as well.
Yeah, exactly. So that's
we're gonna do Smaug next time maybe, and then wait to do the end of the movie after we talk about Smaug. Yeah, I think you're right.
Right. So, So cool. So let's think about let's think about doing that next time. And of course, what we have not had to talk about is any new revelations out of New Zealand, because Comic-Con sure went by with a whimper this year.
Well, I've only got the one. Shall I share the one that I shared with you?
The one you alluded to earlier, yeah.
That I alluded to, yeah. Because I mean, if you guys remember last year, I was like obsessed with Comic-Con. I think I was doing, you know, bulletins on a like 5-minute basis last year on Facebook and everything else. But the one thing that I did notice in my news feed this year from Comic-Con was somebody was at the Weta, you know, booth, and there was either I don't know if it was a figure or a picture of Bolg. But the caption was a Gundabad orc. He was not named as Bolg, which gives rise to some conjecture as to whether Bolg's even going to really be a character now. And if he's not going to be a character, I would recommend everybody get a hold of the poster from last year and also the toy set, you know, with Bolg and Gandalf that's still for sale on Amazon, because those suckers are going to be serious collectibles. So yeah, so I mean, to me now there's a question of whether Volk's going to even be a character in the movie.
That's an interesting point. Both about whether he'll be an actual character and about how much a Bolg poster or figurine will be worth if he gets turned into not Bolg.
Yeah,
that's probably a more interesting topic, isn't it?
Yeah. That's kind of like the first edition Cuckoo's Calling books. Like I know a lot of people who are scrambling now to try and find a copy of that book where the inside of where the dust jacket talks about Richard Galbraith instead of J.K. Rowling. I heard about multiple instances of reviewers who got review copies of that book and were like, "Yeah, I'm not reading this," and gave it to their local library. I wonder if there's going to be a rash of thefts from libraries.
Right.
Of course, in my generation, you know, it's the famous Beatles album cover. You know, the one where they're dressed like butchers and they have blood all over them. That got pulled. That was the big, you know. Oh, right. If you have a copy of that album. Anyway, so that was the big thing that for me anyway was the high point is because Dave, you've talked about that before. I mean, I remember in an episode where you said, you know, Azog Bolg is kind of redundant. You know, one or the other, why both? And I thought of that. You know, I think maybe Jackson heard our episode or something and said, oh, you know, Dave's right. Let's pull Bolg.
You're right. I expect to be given credit for this at next year's Comic-Con panel.
But of course, it really completely destroys my hopes for like this intense Bolg Azog, you know, daddy issue dynamic.
And the Zomborg, the whole Zomborg line will go away now, which is a bummer. Now, the other thing that we have not talked about, and I don't know, Yana asked about this, and I said, I know I've only watched it once, and I don't know if y'all have seen it yet, is the extended edition clip that got released, I guess it was yesterday, a conversation between Bilbo and Elrond when they're at Rivendell. And I haven't brought it up. I mean, I don't know, Corey, if you've even seen it yet. I've only seen it once, so I don't really – I don't feel prepared to talk about it. So maybe next time, you know, that'll be maybe our homework, is the three of us make sure we've seen that clip and we can talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, of course, I'm looking forward to doing, you know, possibly two or three episodes on the extended edition when it comes out.
Oh, yeah, good point.
That's going to be fun.
Yep.
I've already pre-ordered my copy. I'm such a fangirl.
I personally, for the longest time, have wanted to do this for Lord of the Rings and think we should for Hobbit. I think a commentary track is in order.
Yes. Yes.
So that would require us to sit down and watch it continuously.
Our own commentary track.
Yes.
It would become, wouldn't it be more like Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of commentary?
it would be like that, but maybe slightly more like, it would be punctuated occasionally with insightful comments or trivia.
With scholarly insights from Corey. Okay.
Well, the problem is we'd have to keep, I if we were doing this spontaneously, we'd have to like keep pausing it because we would want to spend, you know, we would get a new 30 seconds of material.
Oh, I know.
And we'd want to talk about it for like 15 minutes while the movie was continuing to go on.
yeah, that's right.
That would be kind of tricky, but you know, Yana says he wants to hear my first response. Well, you know, actually, we could do that. You know, we could, like, take a pact among us that we actually won't watch it until we watch it together and record our reactions as we watch it together.
That's a great idea. I could get
We could actually do that.
I'm on board for that.
For the extended edition we're talking about, right?
Yeah, extended edition. When the extended edition comes out, that, like, at least the three of us and as many of our viewers and
now would we be allowed pause, you know, like, okay, hit pause. Would we do that? Like, you know, I mean, would we be allowed to do that, or do we have to let it go? Like, well, you know, it'd be good discipline for us to let, you know, we have to let the movie continue. And
yeah, that's true. And then we could do further episodes afterwards to talk more about the stuff that went past.
Otherwise we could end up with like a 5-hour session.
Oh, 5 hours. We did 3 hours on a 2-minute trailer, for crying out loud.
Yep.
5 hours? My goodness.
Yeah.
What would our commentary be on a 3-hour film? You know, a 3.5-hour film.
Oh, and then also on the extended edition, you know, the big set, they've got a mini documentary called The Appendices. Which is very, you know, I mean, that might be also something that
Forget about it. I mean, yeah, we'll have the appendices to the film. We could do, oh, my goodness, yes. And the problem is, of course, like, we're going to run out of time to talk about the extended edition between the extended edition release and the film 2 release.
And the
film,
that's
right.
We're
going to have barely gotten warmed up talking about the extended edition before the film 2 comes along. Anyway, we'll see. I think that the extended edition viewing sounds like fun. I think we should definitely do
that. But I'm in for that. Yes, I'll sign up. I'll make a promise right now that I will not watch the extended edition until the three of us can do it on air.
Yeah, and maybe what we could do actually is maybe we could actually do, if we don't, do you think we'd be permitted to stream the film live if we don't record it, if we don't release a recording of it? A video recording of it, that is, so that we could actually,
ooh,
like, you know, because that way we could, you know, like I was doing the clips from the trailer, I could stream the film, and we just have our audio commentary, and we could only, you know, we could just sort of extract from the audio commentary, or I don't know. Anyway,
do you think Hannah or somebody at your publishers could, you know, do they have the right kind of context to find that out, or would we be opening a can of worms?
I'm personally of the opinion that don't ask if you don't want an answer.
It's better to ask forgiveness than permission.
The chances, if we just do this, the chances of people realizing what we've done are pretty slim, probably, or that they would care enough to do anything about it. So we might as well just do it.
I'm gonna have to edit this out of the podcast.
Yeah, okay. Right, yeah, that's true. This is the one problem with my assertion is that we're going on record planning it now.
That's right. Planning to do mischief. Yeah.
Exactly.
Anyway, I think that's a great idea. But if I'll remind you guys that, you know, like Giannis, I mean, let's try and watch this little clip of him and Elrond talking, because I actually came away with it with the feeling that Elrond might have been actually sowing seeds of you know, because he ends by saying, oh, you're welcome to stay here if you want, to Bilbo. Right. And because Bilbo's obviously having doubts, and I'm thinking, I wonder if he's trying to undermine Thorin with that, you know, that he's, because he talked to Bilbo a bunch about, oh, I know you like home and this kind of thing. So anyway, so I need to watch it again, but let's, I'll remember that maybe we start off next time with just a little bit of a talk about this little clip that they released.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. No, we could definitely do that. In fact, we could do a little viewing and discussion of that clip at the beginning of our next episode if we wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, anyway, however, we should probably
That's a great idea.
Bring this episode to a merciful close, as we've passed our 2-hour limit now, which is the most patience we can really possibly expect. Really more than we should expect people to have, but certainly would be.
I know our numbers have gone from 30 to 25 in the live attendees, so we're starting to lose our audience here.
Exactly. So anyway, so let's sign off now. But we look forward to talking about those clips and talking about Smaug, I think, for the next episode.
Yes, and I think that sounds like a logical thing.
And we should be able to do that round about 2 weeks from now. So look forward to another hour's warning before the next episode. So thanks, everybody, for joining us again, as always. It's been fun having you in the discussion here, and we look forward to next time. So thanks for listening, and Godspeed.